This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Hey everyone, it's Estet Herndon, political reporter for the New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent, I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
What is the issue? That's what the presidential election is about. That's why when President Obama was running, he said the issue is healthcare. And so that's what people dealt with, and that's actually what happened. I'm saying that there are two issues here, climate and failed government.
I'm Katie Kingsbury from the New York Times editorial board, and welcome to The Choice, a new podcast that brings you behind closed doors and into the exclusive deliberations process around the New York Times pick for the 2020 presidential candidate. In each episode, you'll hear Democratic presidential candidates make their pitch as they interview for the biggest job of their career. Every election year, the board chooses a candidate after closed-door, off-the-record interviews and a lot of internal debate. But the stakes are so high in 2020, and we think voters deserve to hear how we decided on our pick as the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. So we're giving you access to these conversations and the debates that followed so you can make the choice for yourself. To learn more about how the board works and who's on it, go back and listen to episode 1 of this series. We've trimmed each of these interviews down, but if you'd like to read the full transcript, you can find them on nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. After speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders, we talked to a candidate with a slightly different point of view. Businessman Tom Steyer.
Yet another Democrat is jumping into the 2020 presidential race. Billionaire activist Tom Steyer announced today that he will seek the presidency after saying earlier this year.
From Washington these days. I'm Tom Steyer, and I approve this message. Let's make change happen.
Tom Steyer is pitching himself as the candidate who best understands the economy. Mr. Steyer worked at Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs before starting his own hedge fund, Farallon Capital Management, which is where he made his fortune. He left Farallon in 2012 and has since focused his money on fighting climate change and impeaching Donald Trump. He's also started Next Gen America, a political action committee that has contributed millions to Democrats in every election since. He's running as the candidate best suited to get money out of politics and tax the wealthy to even the scales for the 99%. You may not have heard of Mr. Steyer, but it's possible you saw his TV commercials calling for Donald Trump's impeachment. They started running back in 2017 after he put millions of dollars into creating a grassroots online network called Need to Impeach. In January 2019, he said he wouldn't run for president and instead would focus on impeaching Donald Trump. By July, he had declared his candidacy, which is what brought him to the Times headquarters for an endorsement interview.
Mr. Steyer, the center...
Call me Tom, please.
Okay, thanks. Tom, the Center for Responsive Politics has estimated that the $100 million you plan to spend on your campaign could fully fund 5 Senate races. Do you truly believe that running for president is the best use of your wealth?
Well, as I'm sure you know, since you work for the New York Times and have done your research, I started one of the biggest grassroots organizations in the United States, Next Gen America, and we... In 2018, did the largest youth voter mobilization, I think, in American history. I think I also have a partnership, at NextGen has a partnership with national labor unions to go door to door that called For Our Future. We also do it separately under a different name in California. But I think we knocked on over 15 million doors in 2016 and over 10 million doors last year. Both of those grassroots organizations are ongoing. So in fact, I'm sure I'm not legally allowed to run them as long as I'm running for president, but I continue to support them and they're doing the work. So do I believe that we will be doing an enormous amount of work specifically on the swing Senate races in the United States of America? Why, yes, I do. Well, do I know that for sure? Well, no, I don't, because I'm not running them. I'm not allowed to talk to them. But I believe if you go look and see where NextGen is, I'll be shocked if they're not in Arizona, Colorado, Iowa, Maine, North Carolina. What are the other swing Senate races? So in answer to your question, it's not a question of either or.
Mr. Steyer, I need to ask, I mean, your values are admirable. I think I'm still trying to get my head around why you think you're the right messenger at this moment for those values and for the next 4 and possibly 8 years of this country's future.
Okay, I think that's a very fair question. I'll give you 3 quick answers. One is, I'm the person in this race who has put by far the highest priority on climate, who has spent the most time actually working on it effectively for more than a decade, who has a history on it, who has a plan actually. If we actually are going to do something about climate, I believe I'm the person who's going to do it. That's the first point. Because I think I'm the person who's going to do it regardless of whether the Congress passes.
But there's literally no Democratic candidate who doesn't have climate as one of their key priorities on their platform.
I know.
So it's, you think it's because of your history that...
I think it's not their number one priority, and they never would say it's their number one priority, and I will. And I think that that's completely different. Second thing is, look, I don't think this is, you know, common wisdom. I actually think this government's broken, really. If you look and see the issues we're dealing with, we have a government that is not working for the United States, and you can look at so many different issues and see it's true. You know, you can look at immigration reform. Last time, we have 11 to 13 million people living in this country without documentation. They're here for an average of 15 years. Everybody knows they're here. It's an open secret. We have no action on it. You can look at gun violence. You can look at the cost of health care. You can look at a $1 trillion deficit with full employment. You can go just down the line. You cannot tell me this government is working on the basic stuff of government.
But again, that's, we're, you know, there are multiple candidates already in this race whose, the premise of whose candidacy is literally that, that and broken government, corrupt government.
Yeah.
What is it that you plan to do that's different to fix it?
I'm willing to actually change Washington.
But how?
And here's the answer. You know, if you look at what I've said I would push for term limits for congresspeople and senators. I would push for direct democracy, that we'd actually have a national referendum. I think what we've seen in, I mean, I do all the other stuff too. You know, public funding of elections, end of Citizens United, end of make it much easier to vote and end voter suppression. Yeah, I do all that stuff that everybody else is doing too. No one else will actually talk about changing the structure of Washington, D.C. So really, they won't even say they're against it. People won't even say they're against term limits.
But changing the structure of Washington, D.C., in a lot of ways, even things that you've just said, would require actually changing the Constitution.
Yeah. But I think the question in the United States is going to be, and the presidential election is a huge question, is what is the issue in the United States? What is the issue? That's what the presidential election is about. That's why when President Obama was running, he said the issue is health care. And so that's what people dealt with, and that's actually what happened. I'm saying that there are two issues here, climate and failed government. And the question I would ask you guys is, who really wants to change Washington, D.C.? I have spent a decade running props and building grassroots organizations, taking on the companies who I believe actually get their way in Washington, D.C., who are getting their way in climate change. There's a reason we've never had a climate change legislation passed in Washington, D.C., which is oil and gas companies don't want it.
And people think it's more complicated than that. It's not more complicated than that.
I think there's no question you're right about that, and there's no question that your diagnoses of major problems are right. But again, to bring it back to the question of you as the messenger, you know, I know you don't like comparisons to Donald Trump, and I think that's fair to a degree, but we've seen over the last 3 years how a businessman with literally no experience in elected politics has run the country. You've talked about running for governor of California, you've talked about running for the Senate. Those seem like great ways to get a degree of experience in a huge, important state that you live in and that you've already done amazing work in. Why would you not go that route before trying to take in the highest office of the land?
I don't think anyone else has. The third thing I'll say is this. I'm the person here who actually understands economics and understands what makes the country run economically. I think I say completely different things. I think completely differently. I don't think anybody else in this race actually is talking about growth or what will make America prosperous and equitable.
Say I'm an 18-year-old voter and I am disillusioned by capitalism and the way in which this economy is running, and I see someone like you, a rich, older white man, pitch me as to why I should trust you to be our president.
Look, unchecked capitalism's failed. I completely agree. The question is, what are we going to do to make it work for the people of the United States? And I think the answer is we can't give up on growth, but what we have is so shockingly inequitable that to me, your argument is exactly right. And it proves that, in fact, what I'm saying about broken government is true. I come at it in a bunch of different ways. Let's just start with the easy part, which is tax. This is a system which has changed the tax rules for rich people and big corporations and giving them gigantic tax breaks because on the assumption that government doesn't work, government doesn't matter, government support of people and investment in people doesn't matter. I proposed a wealth tax way over a year ago, long before I was running for president, because there's something that's gone crazy in income, but even more so in terms of wealth and assets. I would undo the Republican tax cuts for high-income individuals and for big corporations. I don't think it makes any sense. I think it's wrong, and the assumption there is that it trickles down somehow, and it clearly doesn't. We have 40 years of data. We also have the returns in terms of investment by corporations to see whether, in fact, the claim that if they cut those taxes, there would be more investment, there wasn't. My opinion is the way that the United States is going to be prosperous is for you to prosper. Really. That the United States is the people of the United States, that we think, we describe government programs as spending, but they're actually investment. That actually, if we're going to prosper as a country, you're going to have to prosper. So what does that mean? It means we're going to have government programs that enable you to reach your potential. I'm a gigantic believer in spending a lot more money on education and viewing that as investment in people. I'm a big believer in investing in research. I'm a big believer in investing in healthcare. The way we think about money and the government in the United States is wrong. And I think that if we're going to actually be prosperous in 5 years and your life is going to be what you hope it is, you're going to need government support in the 21st century, period.
So one argument for not spending more money on education is that you could be spending money in a system that's not doing its job and won't make any difference whatsoever. What is your idea about K through 12?
Well, money is necessary but not sufficient in terms of education. I think we all know that. Mm-hmm. But let's be clear. In many parts of this country, there isn't remotely enough money being spent, and it's not being spent in a way that's actually equitable. So if you think about how we fund education in the country, it's mostly by local property taxes.
That's right. It's like
one. And that means only legislating inequality.
One in every $8 is federal, something like that.
Yeah. So we got to start with that fact.
But that's sort of baked into our system.
I understand, but we're talking here about what we should be doing. Mm-hmm. If you go to the red states and look at states where Republicans control the legislature and the governorship, they always start by cutting taxes, and then the second thing they do is cut education. So when you say there's enough money, this country is very unequal between states in terms of how that money is raised, mm-hmm. how much is raised, and how it's spent. Mm-hmm. So my opinion about education is simple. Do we require more money? Yes, we do. Is that enough? Absolutely not. But I think we have to treat teachers differently. I also think we need much broader goals in terms of what we're trying to accomplish. If you look at the places in the United States where the education actually is world class, mm-hmm. where they actually have changed the system, where it's actually worked. And Massachusetts, unfortunately, I say as someone from California who grew up in New York, is the one that I think is the best. They did increase the money across administrations over a period of time. They also had a much broader mandate of what they're trying to achieve educationally.
One of the differences between us and a place like Finland or a place like Shanghai, they expect a lot more of teachers, in Finland in particular. Teacher training is a lot more rigorous. We have a teacher training system that's mediocre and varies widely. I mean, teacher training is terrible here. So I'm trying to get at something.
But my point is, do we need more money? Yes. I said we need to treat teachers differently. Mm-hmm. I mean, the question is, what do you think the role of a teacher is? How significant in society do you think it is? Mm-hmm. I think we treat it exactly the way you're saying. We pay teachers poorly, some places incredibly poorly. The training is insufficient. And in addition, ongoing education is different. I think if you look at the places that crush it from an educational standpoint around the world, mm-hmm. teachers are viewed as like the stewards of the future. Mm-hmm. It's like being a lawyer, a doctor, or an architect. We're going to have to do that if we want to be world-class education. So that means we're going to think differently about the role of a teacher in society, how important it is, because I actually do believe that the way the United States will prosper is by an 18-year-old actually getting the support to achieve what she or he can do. And we're not doing that. We are clearly not doing that, and we are not seeing that way. Look, to me, long-term in the United States, if we're going to be successful and prosperous, we are going to have to build the capability of the American people.
More from our interview after a quick break.
This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sexpionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets, and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in LA, binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice. Mr. Steyer is running on his history of nonprofit philanthropy, which was enabled by the money he made working on Wall Street. After the Great Recession, there is a lot of skepticism out there around those who capitalized on the downturn, especially as the wealth gap continues to widen. We had to ask him about that.
Paul Volcker once asked the Nobel laureate William Sharp what the rise of finance in the late 20th century had contributed to overall economic growth. His answer was nothing. What's wrong with the view that hedge funds and private equity, where much of your money comes from, are simply collecting tolls from everyone else?
If you think about what the role of a financial system in the United States or any place else is, it's to allocate capital, right? That's the job, to figure out on a micro basis, what is worth investing in. And that it's measured in terms of returns in dollars, but that's the job of finance. And if you look at the United States of America and think about how we do money allocation in this society, Bill Sharp was I believe, professor at the Stanford Business School, which I attended. So I actually had a chance to talk to Bill Sharp. I think that's untrue. I think that capital allocation in this society actually turns out to be critical. If you actually look at why the Soviet Union failed, if you'll excuse my saying so, really bad capital allocation. They did central planning by people in a room figuring out where to put capital and where to do things, and they totally failed. And the United States of America has huge issues in terms of fairness. It has huge issues in terms of what values are promoted. I believe that the financial system does not have the rules it needs. So you know, we started a community bank that is from zero to over $1 billion, designed for economic justice, environmental sustainability, and to support businesses owned by women and people of color. So I definitely agree that there are gigantic holes and, you know, unfairnesses and discrimination in our financial system. But in terms of, do I think that the
skillful and professional allocation of capital in a society, is it a critical function for growth? Yes.
By the eve of the financial crisis, more than 40% of profits in this economy were being earned by the financial industry. Yeah. Is that excessive in your view?
Hugely.
Some of
gigantically.
That was you. Some of that was you, right? Some of that was Farallon, which was profiting
massively.
You know
what? I took the giving pledge to give away most of my money while I'm alive.
I understand that, but do you think that the profits you were earning were excessive? Do you think that the role of the financial industry has become distorted in the economy?
Yes. But do I think that professional, skillful capital allocation is critical to a growing society? Yes, I do. And I think that anyone who doesn't think that should take a look at the societies that do it poorly and see how it works out.
At Farallon, you also benefited from the current tax system. In 2000, Farallon sent a letter to investors telling them it would use an offshore company to shelter some of their gains from taxation. Could you please explain why you did that and what role you think such tax shelters should play?
You can take a look at my taxes and see how clean I am. The Farallon lawyers, and I'm not trying to pass it off to them, Farallon did tax planning for its clients according to the laws of the United States of America. Do I agree with those laws? No. You can take a look at my taxes and see what I do. Do I think that's the way it should be? No. Those are the laws of the United States. Do I think they should be changed? Sure, I do. The tax laws of the United States, in my mind, massively advantage people who make a lot of money. And that's a clear example of it, and I'd change them.
Given Farallon's investments in companies like FedEx and Target and Comcast that are well known for resisting unions, why should the average American worker have any faith in you? And do you think unions need to be stronger in this country?
I do think they need to be much stronger. And I've spent over a decade partnering with unions, and not just going door to door with them, but in every single proposition I've ever run, we've had union support. And I've, you know, my attitude is working people have been screwed for 40 years.
And your earlier investments in companies that fought unions vehemently?
The reason I left Farallon, I could have stayed at Farallon and done every single thing I'm doing, and they could have paid me a lot of money for being a symbolic leader. And the reason I left was I needed to make a clean break with what I saw was a system that was off the rails. You were asking me earlier, what do I think about capitalism? It's not working for people. I agree. And so I felt like I had to make a clean break, not stay and get paid a bunch of money, because there's something wrong here. And actually, I know how it works and how to change it. So,
you know, I just get the feeling like your pitch is you made a lot of money, you've had a series of epiphanies, you've changed your mind, and now you're spending your money in things that you believe. And it's, you know, given the climate of the country now, given the emphasis on inequality, it doesn't seem like a very strong pitch to make to the average person.
Look, I think what I'm doing and what I have a history of doing, this isn't like I just came to this. I've been doing this for a decade. And so do I think that all those things you're saying are true? Yes. Am I someone who's actually worked on that? Yes. Am I someone who's taken a pledge to give most of my money away while I'm alive? Yes. Look, it's exactly like saying you've been driving a car for 60 years. How can you be someone who's leading on climate change? Because we have to make a change as a society. And am I part of that society? Sure. And if I've lived in that society and participated in that society and played, you know, and run my life according to the rules of that society, sure I have. And my point is those rules should change, not just for me, but for everybody. I've changed, and I'm asking everybody else to go make the same change I've made.
But how is that different than expecting Exxon to take the lead on solving climate change? Why would we trust them to do that?
Because they haven't spent a decade actually turning themselves inside out to make sure that happened. I have a history of doing this. If you look at the people in the race, the person in this race who has done by far the most on climate is me. The person who knows the most about it and has actually accomplished things in it and spent time and effort and money making sure it happens is actually me. So it's not a question of Exxon. Exxon has a history that's exactly the opposite. If you look at what I've pushed for, it's been, you know, we've pushed for 50% clean energy by 2030 to clean up generation. Also pushed to end fossil fuel expansion, whether it be pipelines or fossil fuel plants, including natural gas plants. So I've pushed to stop specific plants and specific pipelines. I think we've also pushed in California. If you look at where the greenhouse gas emissions are actually coming from, it's like the number one is cars, transportation in general. So we've pushed for a bunch of things that include public transportation to replace cars in addition to EVs, but on across the board on that. I think also if you really want to go and see what we're talking about, we're also talking about industrial and agriculture. We've worked on both those things. This is a, you know, I think it's easy. I think people like to think about generation. I mean, the basic goal is clean up generation, electrify everything, and do energy efficiency. That's the basic program for the world. So clean up generation is first. But, you know, if you look across the spectrum of where greenhouse gases are coming from, focusing entirely on generation isn't enough. Because, you know, you're seeing greenhouse gases come from across the spectrum. And so we've been working across the spectrum.
Turning to a slightly different subject, I mean, should someone, a candidate who hasn't energized voters, become president?
And can they?
You
guys are worried about something that can't happen. The person who's going to become president is the person who gets the most votes. So the question would
be... Not necessarily.
Well, that's true, too. Electoral votes, okay.
Yes, this is a leading question.
Touché. The question is going to be, who has a message that's differential, important, and is trusted to bring it home? And that's the question. And so that's what I spend my time trying to say, is I think I have something different to say. I didn't run because I thought something would say it. Somebody would say it. I disagree with you guys. I don't think there's anyone else in this race who actually is going to do what's necessary in climate, period. I think that people inside the Beltway really don't want to change the way it works. I think that.
How do you run for office and win election by talking candidly about the broad constituency for racism in this country?
I don't think you can. First of all, I think we have to talk about race. I don't think you can talk about the United States of America without talking about race. I don't think you can talk about inequality in the United States without talking about race. I've been saying, if I'm president, on the first day, we're going to have a formal commission on race.
Well, listen, I tell people all the time, and I write all the time, the United States does not have a race problem. The United States has a racism problem.
Look, and it's deep. And if you look at the United States of America, we've never told the truth about what's happened here in our history. We've never apologized for slavery. It's amazing. We've never been willing to go back and tell the truth. I believe that policy comes out of narrative. That actually Ronald Reagan got his policies through by telling a narrative that changed the way people think, that was terrible, including racist. And so the question is, how do we retell the narrative truthfully so we can get policies that actually address how we got here and make it fair and try and repair what's happened? So when I think about what are we going to do to pull together, first of all, I think winning really helps, and I'm not talking about winning an election. I think as a country, we have some huge tasks. One is, honestly, to save the world. People are unwilling to face the fact that we actually have to save the world, and it has to be us. And that if we do that, it will make us better paid, richer, healthier, we'll address some of the justice issues, because environmental justice has got, I mean, I call my climate plan a justice-based climate plan. But doing that actually will pull us together. The actual task together of building a sustainable world and passing it on and leading the world morally again is something I actually believe will pull us together. But I also believe we're going to have to be much more honest. And I think that the conversation about race specifically, not with this, starting from the narrative, but also talking about solutions as a result, is something that's critical for us spiritually.
Next, we needed to hear more about Mr. Steyer's ideas on foreign policy. Just a context note, we interviewed him right before the Washington Post reported that senior government officials lied for 18 years about the war in Afghanistan.
I want to sort of ask you about foreign policy and the military, just to see sort of how you would approach things differently than the Trump administration. Maybe you could talk about ending the war in Afghanistan. The Trump administration is negotiating with the Taliban and seeming to kick the existing Afghan government to the wind if they reach a deal. Is that an appropriate approach for ending the war there?
Well, let's take a step back. Afghanistan is the longest running war in the United States. We're very concerned that when we leave, we're going to leave a vacuum and there's going to be a lot of violence ensuing. It's probably true. And I think if you look at the United States of America, We have been willing to commit troops without a clear plan of what we're trying to accomplish, without a clear plan of how we're going to get out, and unilaterally, as opposed to as part of an actual international force. And so as a result, we're stuck, you know, we're in the same situation we've been in before, where we're basically the de facto peacekeepers in a country that has got, you know, gigantic internal strife.
And is that wrong? I mean, what should our role in Afghanistan be?
If we could not be in Afghanistan right now, we would not be in Afghanistan right now. Or if we were there, we would be part, honest to God, of an international coalition that was there on a peacekeeping mission. But we would not be doing what we're doing now, which is basically being the unilateral peacekeeper in a country where we, I absolutely believe that.
So we should leave tomorrow?
No, I think we're going to do what we can to get out and to leave it in as good a place as possible, which means negotiating with the people on the ground, doing everything we can to see if there's a way to bring in other international actors in a coalition to try and have things go. But do I think that we're going to leave it in a perfect position? No, I don't. And so we can either accept that as truth and deal with it and try and minimize it and try and do everything we can, or we can stay forever. Those are our choices.
Mr. Steyer. You've talked about making climate change your priority and that you're the only candidate that's been willing to do that. And, you know, I appreciate you setting a priority. I think that's a tough thing to get candidates to do. Particularly, there's been a lot of, I think, wariness with healthcare policy has grown, especially in the wake of the debates because it got so much airtime. But the focus on that is predicated on some pretty dire needs, and it didn't come out of nowhere that Democrats chose to focus on that. How do you make the case to voters who can't afford their insulin, who don't have adequate health care, for whom health care policy, however boring it gets, is actually a matter of life and death? How do you convince those people that climate change needs to come first? Because to your earlier point, whatever you focus on, whatever you set as your priority, is the thing that's going to get done. Obama got health care done because he didn't prioritize climate change.
The two things I've said that I would do are climate change and break the corporate stranglehold on our government. Look, the reason I think we have the healthcare system we do is because of the drug companies, the private hospitals, insurance companies. So do I understand? Look, I've gone around this country. I've had people tell me without the Affordable Care Act, I'd die. I've gone to the states where they haven't done Medicaid expansion. I see what it means for human beings. What is going on with the American people is they're getting their ass kicked. And this is a perfect example of the American people getting their ass kicked by corporations for money.
So again, how do you make the case to people who are getting their ass kicked in all of these ways?
Because I'm the person who's going to say there's two things I'm going to do: climate change and break this corporate stranglehold. If we break the corporate stranglehold, we're going to get fairness. Am I going to push really hard for this government to negotiate against every one of those healthcare companies? Yes. Am I going to push really hard to get passage? We're only going to get passage. Look. One of the reasons I was running is I don't believe this, that we're going to get passage of any of these sweeping healthcare changes until we get changed the way this government's working. Look, if you think about the Affordable Care Act, there are four big special interests in healthcare, right? Drug companies, insurance companies, private hospitals, and doctors. The Affordable Care Act went 4 for 4, right? They're all in back of it, helped them all. That was the way it was designed. It was politically intelligent to get it done. Medicare for all, 0 for 4. Public option, 0 for 4. Maybe 1 for 4, actually. But my point is, to fight those people, we're going to have to take away their ability to control this. Really.
So what do you do in the short term?
I think in the short term, what you do is you negotiate like hell.
We have a president right now whose whole plan was predicated on negotiating like hell with drug companies.
No, you have a president right now whose actual plan in healthcare has been to take away as much healthcare as possible from Americans because he hates the Affordable Care Act because it's called Obamacare. And he's refused to do the things to build on Obamacare. He's done everything he can actually to make it worse, to make it more expensive and less effective. So actually, that's what the president's been doing. And so there are within the Affordable Care Act, we could be doing a much better job if Mr. Trump weren't trying to sabotage the Affordable Care Act. So there's a bunch of stuff that we could be doing to make it much more responsive to work on costs, which we're not doing. But to get the real changes that we're talking about, and I happen to have been from the beginning a public option person, that in order to get that, we're going to actually have to have political change. We can make the Affordable Care Act a lot better, but we can't get what I would think of as affordable health care as a right for every American until we get political change.
You
presented yourself as the one candidate who is willing to stand up for the primacy of climate change as an issue. And then she asked you to defend that, and you didn't. You said, no, I want to do health care too. Why won't you stand up for the primacy of climate change?
I will. I declare a state of emergency.
Well, do it right now. How do you explain to a voter who thinks health care is their number one priority that climate change is actually the most important?
Look, if we don't get this right, then it's going to overtake the lives of every single American.
What do you mean when you say you'll declare an emergency on day one? What does that look like? What do you do?
I think it basically there's some emergency powers to the president. What it really means is determining how we're going to generate power, putting in rules about power generation, putting in rules about transportation, how many, you know, miles per gallon rules, EV rules, putting in rules about building efficiency. Look, those are things we can do. The president can put in a whole bunch of rules in terms of how we generate and use power on day one. What can happen is the idea that we'll spend all the money that's necessary in order to get things done. But we can put in rules, and I'm a big believer, just so you know, in actually putting in rules. What we've seen in California over the last 12 years is that putting in rules really works.
Given his political activism around impeachment, we thought it made sense to ask him whether impeachment was actually a good idea if it hurt Democrats' chances of winning in 2020. Just a quick context note, when we recorded this interview, the House of Representatives had not yet voted on the articles of impeachment.
There are plenty of voters and Democratic House members and senators, and the president will have to speak to these people who think that impeachment has been a distraction from issues like health care and income inequality that impact your lives. What do you say to those people? Because obviously this is a big deal, you know, in Washington and in certain political circles in the Democratic base, but not everybody sees this as the end-all be-all. So how do you address those people?
Look, do I think that when a system goes awry, the way this system has gone awry with the most corrupt president in history, that it distracts us from solving real problems in real time? Yes. Absolutely it does. Do I think that this Congress was really going to solve health care? No, I don't. Do I think this Congress was really going to solve immigration? Baloney. I don't think that's true for a second. I think when you have a serious moral issue in your country and you choose not to do it for political reasons, it's a gigantic mistake.
So even if President Trump is reelected, then it was still the right thing to do?
Yes. Look, do I think that it makes the president stronger to be exposed as being a criminal, which seems to be the implication of your question? No. I don't think it makes him stronger. Do I think that what the Republicans are doing in this is wrong? Yeah, I think it's wrong.
But there are plenty of political realities that tell us that there may actually be a political consequence to impeachment.
And what are those realities?
Well, we saw in 1998, for instance.
In 1998, I believe the vote came after the election in 98, and in 2000, the Republicans won everything.
But the investigation came before.
And you know something? The Republicans did, they lost a few seats in the, but they kept everything. It did not hurt the Republicans. In fact, I believe that whatever his name is, George Bush, ran on the theory of bring decency back to Washington, D.C., and he became president of the United States. So there is no theory here that this somehow crushed the Republicans. And that was at a place where a president was 60% approval rating or something, and there was something like 29% of Americans who thought he should be impeached. I don't see it comparable, and I don't see the crimes as comparable. I think it's a completely different situation. And if you guys are worried that impeachment is going to make Republicans vote, my suggestion to you is stop worrying. Republicans are going to vote.
Do you think, then, that Democrats should run on an impeachment narrative, that they should make it a key part of their campaign?
No, and I'm not running on it. My opinion about this is the right thing to have done, period. It was important to do. Personally, I still hope that the televised hearings will show the American people what a crook this guy is. Seriously. But if you're worried about, do I think it was the right thing to do? Absolutely. But is that what we should be running on? No, we should be running on the not talking about Donald Trump, talking about what we can do.
So that was most of the editorial board's conversation with Tom Steyer. To read the full conversation, visit newyorktimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. If you want to hear what the board had to say after Mr. Steyer walked out of the room, and for analysis on the impact of impeachment and billionaires in the 2020 race, check out the deliberations episode. It also comes out today.
The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner, and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.